Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Hey, Patrick, what's the deal? Are you cold or something?
What do you mean, Jim?
I mean, what's with that stupid hat and gloves?
All right, day two of the replacements countdown today.
Day two.
Let me ask you guys before we play the next song on the list here. What do you think it is about the replacements that got us so much response to this thing? And before you do that, let's just introduce ourselves. The show is Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
Phil Ingrassia.
Phil's with us all week. Thanks for coming, Phil. Phil, a Minnesotan.
That's right.
Yes. Minneapolisian. What is that?
Well, I'm from the Twin Cities.
Okay. All right. That's fine. All right. So what do you think it is about the band?
Well, I can speculate that this band is right in not only a sort of demographic in the sense of time, like probably, you know, for guys our age, we're all right around the same age here. You know, we really sort of cut our teeth in that early to late 80s. That whole period of the development of college rock and indie rock and replacements were right at the heart of that. I mean, if you think about that book, Our Band Could Be Your Life by Michael Azarod, the bands that are in there for me are all like core pillar bands. Like that's my tent. Those are my tent poles that my, you know, my career is really, my listening career, my passion is really built on. And the replacements are right there in the middle of it. And they also were just so unpretentious. And there's so many great stories about the band and they were so likable. At that time, they just stuck the middle finger up to everything that was sort of happening with MTV. And you all, I don't know, I felt that way. And every time they did it, I was like, yeah, they're speaking out, which was great.
And I think, you know, it's such a relatable lyrics and just the subject matter, you know, being my 20s at that time. I mean, everything they were singing about, I got, you know, I understand what he's talking about.
Yeah.
So I think, just the, you know, where he fits in as a singer-songwriter and then, you know, the band around him that he put together and was, it was just of that time, you know, very important band.
You make a great point, Phil, because I know personally in my life, members of my family had essentially told me, you need to get a goddamn job. Like, you can't be sitting around this garage playing music with those degenerates all the time.
Right.
And that certainly rang true.
Well, yeah, because he would write about just the most basic things like that in a way that seemed real. And then he would write about more complex emotional subjects and in a way that also seemed real. I think that's it. And I think there's a combination of what you two guys are saying, which is that they seem to have the real spirit of rock and roll. Like they were not playing the game. In fact, they would do a lot to purposely go against the game, right? Maybe even too much so, where it can be hard to even like them.
Definitely argue that.
But, you know, they made their audience work, I think, to some extent. But you had a respect for them, that they were doing this because they loved the music, first and foremost. But at the same time, that never felt like an act either, because underneath it was, like, really quality work.
Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
They weren't doing it just... They weren't doing it for show. They weren't like a hair band or whatever that was like sort of fake rebellion, right? This had the sort of the combination of both like quality songwriting, quality recordings, but yet a real like rock and roll attitude.
Yeah. You know? And, you know, just to sort of follow that up again from Bob Mayer's excellent book, Trouble Boys, you see a repeating theme in that book that if there was a big occasion, especially if that occasion had something to do with the record company or exposure, you were pretty sure everyone around the band was extremely scared because they knew they were going to do something crazy, and they many, many times they did. And then, interestingly enough, everyone also said the next show after that was going to be probably the best show they played up to at that point in their life, because they would just make up for it and, you know, and go all out. Or they were so hungover, you know, that they had to be halfway sober when they actually played that next show.
Yeah, I don't know if you can look at the clip from Saturday Night Live when they were on, but it was pretty much of a disaster.
Yeah.
And they were banned from TV. So, you know, every time they were just about there, something seemed to get in the way, and it was usually them.
Yeah, yeah. They're in their own way.
So all this week we're counting down our listener favorites of replacement songs. We put this out to a group of listeners. core listeners, and we got, what? How many?
32 participants. Thank you to each and every one of you who participated in this poll and did this hard challenge for us. We really appreciate it.
So they all gave us their top 10 list, and then we made a master list of 15 from that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a little bit of spillover there. And we are in day two of this countdown. We are at number 12. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny that we're talking about what makes it such a great band, because at number 12 is a song that's essentially a solo song.
Yes, it is.
Within Your Reach off of Hootenanny.
Yes.
And Hootenanny, which is essentially one of the sort of like snottiest records, you know, albums in the, that you'll ever hear from
really
a band,
is.
has this song on it, right?
Yeah.
It's an amazing song. And that shows you that, boy, they had more going on than a minute 30 punk band going, right? I mean, that is something else.
Peter Jesperson, who was, you know, an early supporter and manager of the band and, you know, really gave them a lot of confidence, did want Paul to write and record solo. He encouraged that soft side of Paul Westerberg. And the story, again, in Bob Mayer's book is that Paul and Peter were going to go to the studio, and Chris Mars unexpectedly turned up and said, well, hey, what's going on here? You got your guitar case. And, you know, looks, and they went down to the studio, Blackberry Way, and Chris tried to put a live drum track on this, but couldn't do it.
Right.
And, you know, that was hard for him to sort of accept, like, oh, I can't, you know, do this rigid rhythm. Not you'd really want to anyway.
Right.
But yeah, it just, you know, shows that other side was constantly developing in Paul.
And he purposely didn't want Bob and Tommy around for this, because he knew they wouldn't like it.
Right.
This wasn't the kind of music that they wanted to do. So he had to cut it, you know, himself.
Yeah.
Right. So the drum machine, there's the, you know, here just kind of a light sort of synthesizer in the background, and then that guitar, that sort of phased guitar, which just gives it such a, the song, such like an aura to it almost. It's like you're hearing something that's sort of otherworldly with this song.
It's got that tremolo kind of effect that really does kind of, you know, make it a little spacey and cool, but also appropriate for something where you're trying to get to something and it's, you know, hard to grasp or hard to make yourself actually get to where you need to go. So it's cool in that sense,
too. Space age love song.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And then the key line to that, I can't live without your touch. I'll die within your reach.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, good grief. Some people will hang it up after writing a line like that. That's the best line you've ever written in your career. Yeah.
A couple of listener comments on this song. Mark Neese says it's an early sign that Paul was a brilliant songwriter. So I think, you know, there is a feeling here. If you were listening to Hootenanny, this is my comment, not Mark's. If you were listening to Hootenanny, you know, which is their third album, where they're still essentially considered a young punk band, this song, I can only imagine, like, if you were already a fan of this band and you heard this album, and then all of a sudden this song came out, and you'd be like, what is that?
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
And maybe at first you might really just be taken aback by it, but if you listen to it, you'd be like, what? This band really has some depth. You know, they're at least the particular songwriter does. Yeah,
exactly. And I would say too, on the album Hootenanny, I don't know if you guys know that, you know, in 1963 there was actually a folk compilation called Hootenanny, and they basically just stole the design wholesale. It's
beautiful.
Took those colored things. You can look it up. It's on Crestview Records.
Yeah, I find hilarious because it feels so un rock and roll, but yet so punk at the same time. Right.
You know. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
That was the kind of retro feel, and like the Clash stole for London Calling,
right,
the album cover from Elvis, right. So that was kind of a thing back then.
Yeah, and famously, although we won't discuss this song, I do not know if the title track got any votes, but apparently literally they just were screwing with the engineer and all switched instruments and made that song, right. Hootenanny, and
it kicks off the record. It's like, who Westberg would do like, that?
Side one, song one, right there, dude. Yeah. I'm like, wait, this is the key album of your career. No, Hootenanny, no votes. Sorry about that.
Did Run It get any votes?
Run It got one vote, and that was our good friend Brad Mailer, and that was a favorite song of ours back in the day.
It's good. There's also a funny story in the Bob Mayer book about Hootenanny, where they had like a first pressing or a test pressing or something like that, and they were at a club in Minneapolis, and the DJ was like, oh, you know, we'll play something from it.
Yeah.
You know, we'll play this right now, this like club full of people. This will be awesome. And then he's like, which song should I play? And they were like, well, just start from the beginning, play the first song. And he's playing Hootenanny, you know, to this group of people. You know, it's just, it's not a song meant for that kind of listening experience at all, right? But it's funny. They just like to mess with people, you know, make you, again, work for being a fan.
That's
of theirs, right. A couple more listener comments on Within Your Reach, though. EPJ, Echo Park Jimmy, just says, Say Anything soundtrack. So I don't know if you guys remember that, but that's the song is on the Say Anything soundtrack. I think it's played at the very end of the movie where they're like getting on the airplane. John Cusack and Ione Skye, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that did. Now that was later on. That wasn't this era. That was like late 80s that was included. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think it introduced some people to the Replacements because of that. And then Harris King says, this song especially spoke to me as a teenager with its theme of unrequited love, and I have always dug the drum machine, he says.
Yeah.
There is something cool. It fits.
Yeah, it
really well with that song.
It really does.
It sounds like a bedroom recording almost in some ways, right?
Yeah. And you know, this album is so varied, and you know, the flow of it, there's so much different stuff on it that it really does fit. It's a great thing that kind of holds the record together in some ways.
And that's why it's such a great title for it, because you've got all these different
exactly.
You know, it's like a Hootenanny because there's all kinds of different styles on it.
Yeah,
right. It's really a fun record.
All right, let's get back to the countdown.
Okay.
Me on the Bus, coming in at number 11, so just outside the top 10
on the countdown.
First one on the countdown from Tim.
1985,
which you're gonna hear is kind of a fan favorite album as we go through
really
this
is,
countdown.
Jim.
Yeah,
yes it is. Quite a few votes for a lot of these songs on here.
Yep. So you mentioned first off, Patrick, with the last when we were talking about the last thing, you mentioned something about kind of a surf music influence maybe with the Replacements, but this one is like kind of a rockabilly song.
It really is. Yeah, it's got that sort of slapback Sun Studios kind of feel to it, which is really cool. Yeah,
totally.
It's a very Minneapolis song, and I guess Paul still doesn't drive, so he got he got around on the bus, and so did I. I took the bus into Minneapolis every day during the summer to go work at a hotel.
Wow.
And it's true stories. Romances could develop on these MTC red buses in Minneapolis because you would see the same people every day. And you're, you know, teenager, early 20s, and you see these girls going down to their office jobs, and all of a sudden you strike up conversations and let's go, you know? So that's another thing that is just so Minneapolis about about this band and this song. It's, you know, people live that every day driving into the Twin Cities to work or whatever.
The rhyming of transfer and answer on this song are just absolutely brilliant. I will tell you, the first band I ever played in was formed in the fall of 1985, and by summer 1986 we'd actually gotten a paying gig, and I put Kiss Me on the Bus on my top 10 list because we played that song in our first ever paying gig that night. I was not good enough on guitar to play and sing at the same time, so I was just the singer, so you can imagine how awkward that was. I say that to Jim because he performed a similar role in a band, but I don't think there's an extant recording of it, but I'd love to hear what it sounded like. But we did play Kiss Me on the Bus.
Really?
That was our album, Bo. In 85 to 86, I mean, this was as big as any record that was out there, Tim, for us.
Oh, it absolutely was.
Yeah.
It absolutely was. And this was one of the songs that they played on Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
And I think Sire thought this, you know, had definitely like pop hit potential. Yep. Mm-hmm. The only thing I will say is that I'm not sure it really fit in with the time. It doesn't sound like mid-80s. You know, what would be a hit song,
but it's
certainly poppy and it's catchy, and I think a lot of people really love it, as we see. Now, you said something interesting, Phil. I want to dive in on this a little bit. So you took this song to mean that they are adults. The people, the characters in the song are adults riding like a city bus, right? Mm-hmm. Is that how you always took it too?
Always.
So did I. And I really liked this song because of that, because I thought like, this is a really kind of sweet song about just kind of, you know, they're not successful people. There's not this grand romance or anything. It's just like a little moment, right? Kiss Me on the Bus, right? Like, we're just living this kind of maybe harder life, and we just, you know, it gives us this little moments or of romance, whatever, gives us this little bit of pleasure, everything. But then I've read other places where people take this to mean it's like school kids, like a school bus. And I never took it that way.
I never,
but there is a part about
that way.
But you know, you don't have to act so adult or something like that. And I think maybe that gives it away.
Yeah.
And if you're a kid listening to it and that's your frame of reference, that could be.
That's true. Yeah. If you were riding teenagers. A school bus every day.
I see those red MTC buses and what I used to do, and I know that he did because he doesn't drive.
That's right. Yeah. He doesn't. And funny, Tommy doesn't drive either. So it's really weird. But the Replacements did write a lot of like sort of teenage kind of perspective songs. At least earlier on, you know, and the first album was Sorry Ma, I Forgot to Take Out the Trash, right? It's all from that perspective. Right. So I guess I could see how people would see that, and maybe that's true. I don't know. But I kind of like it better as the city bus.
Me too.
Story, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, it's a great little song. I think there was a period, I don't think I had this on my top 10 now, but if I had done this maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years ago or whatever, this would have been a top 10 for me. I mean, it's just one of those songs that you can kind of like play it and put it on repeat because you want to hear it like five times in a row.
Exactly. To decipher all those words and just figure out how clever it is. But, you know, interestingly enough, Tim, was the record where Bob Stinson really didn't play a lot on it. A lot of the guitar solos were from Paul. He did.
Well,
you know, Bob had some on this record, but their sound was beginning to change.
And if I remember correctly in the book, so Tim was where Bob, you know, wasn't as engaged anymore in the band, and he wouldn't show up a lot of times for sessions. And if he did show up, he wasn't prepared.
That's right.
And I believe, if I remember correctly, that the producer, Tommy Ramone, Tom Erlei, who a lot of people have problems with the production on that album, and I don't disagree with that, but I believe he actually played that guitar
solo. Oh, is that
right?
Oh, okay.
In there because
Kiss Me on the Bus.
Because Bob just wasn't able to do it right and then stopped showing up or whatever. And so he plays that solo there.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. We did get a couple of comments here. I'm going to read one from a listener about Kiss Me on the Bus. This is from Eric Didrikson. And he says, here's an embarrassing story. All right, this is the best kind of story. A few years back, I was at a hip eatery playing hip music when Prince's When You Were Mine came on. Through a mouthful of food, I said, "Whoa, who's doing this cover of Kiss Me on the Bus?" I've since learned the error of my ways, but I wasn't entirely wrong. Kiss Me on the Bus is to When You Were Mine what Hendrix's version of All Along the Watchtower is to Dylan's, a revved-up reimagination that far outshines the original.
Interesting.
I don't... Yeah, When You Were Mine. I love that song. Do you think they're similar songs? I guess.
A little bit, yeah. But...
Do you find, Phil, any sort of overlap between Prince's work and the Replacements in sort of your estimation of their catalog?
Well, they come out of South Minneapolis,
yeah.
Both of them. And certainly Prince had an element of rock that could have played whatever he wanted
yes.
to. I mean, there's some really great Prince songs that have the, you know, the early 80s Minneapolis rock sound,
uh-huh.
you know, the Husker Du, the Soul Asylum, all that stuff. So, I mean, certainly I think it's of the same area. I know they were mutual admirers of each
yeah,
other.
Yeah, that's interesting too.
Yeah, totally. So speaking of Minneapolis, that leads us perfectly into song number 10 on our countdown.
You take the skyway high above the busy little one-way, in my stupid hat and gloves at night I lie awake wondering if I'll sleep, wondering if we'll meet out in the street. But you take the skyway, it don't move at all like a subway. Got bums when it's cold like any other place. It's warm up inside, sitting down and waiting for a ride beneath the skyway.
Skyway, again off of Pleased to Meet Me,
mm-hmm.
and similar kind of a way to Kiss Me on the Bus. It's about a romance again in these like sort of small moments
yeah.
around the city, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Minneapolis, for people who don't know, has a series of skyways that crisscross the entire downtown, and you can walk through the skyway system and never go outside.
They're like yeah. elevated walkways above the street, right?
Correct.
So you can go from building to building without going outside because it's about 20 below.
Right. And there's a whole subculture of people who you can go shopping in the skyway system, you can eat, you can drink at bars. And so some people never hit the street, you know.
Right.
It and so what's very, very cool about this song is it is so Minneapolis focused, but you can kind of still read into it even if you don't know what a skyway is.
Right, right. And, you know, another one just coming off of Kiss Me on the Bus where he's talking about waiting for his ride, you know.
Yeah.
So another one where it's just, I want to stay warm up here until I can see my ride pull up and then I'm going to jump out and get in the car. So
yeah, the other thing is he talks about one-ways and
yeah.
Minneapolis downtown in the 80s had a lot of one-ways and they've since kind of redone it, but it was very annoying to a lot of people that one-way, and You'd get kind of messed up driving down there sometimes.
Interesting that they cut such a beautiful song about Minneapolis and Memphis, you know, where the heat is more of the problem. But so many songs on Tim and on Pleased to Meet Me were a full flowering of Paul Westerberg's songwriting. And I think it really hit home to me when I got to the point around 1987 or 88 where I was actually good enough to play a guitar and sing at the same time. so many of these songs are so fun to play, and this is a great example. Like Skyway is a pretty simple song when you put your capo on and you play it with three or four chords, and it's so wonderful to sing and really get inside that song. And I love the line, to me, that is a Big Star reference, out in the street, you know, that he kind of puts that in there. I think that's cool. Well, but also Here Comes a Regular, and, you know, so many songs are just really wonderful to play.
So it's interesting where these songs all landed in this countdown, because with today's episode here, we have songs I think that are really kind of similar in a lot of ways. And I relate Skyway also to Within Your Reach, which we talked about. Because to me, I read these lyrics and I'm thinking, again, it's sort of like an unrequited love situation. He sees, there's some woman who he sees in the Skyway, right? But he's not connected with her. He's down on the street,
right?
And there's even lines about, you know, because you mentioned it's like where the place I catch my ride, sitting down and waiting for a ride beneath the Skyway. So the guy who's the protagonist in this song is not up there in the place that's warm. And it even references his stupid hat and gloves, right?
That's right.
He dreams of being up there with her in the Skyway, this glamorous place in Minneapolis, right?
That's where all the office people are, right?
Yeah,
right.
Down
below are the retail people that work in record stores and at the McDonald's and whatever.
Yeah.
It's really funny. You know, I think that you could also think about Aching to Be, you know, thought about not understood, but Aching to Be, you know, it's a similar kind of distance, you know, seeing somebody.
And again, I think a big part of what connects people with Paul Westerberg's songwriting is that he writes a lot about those kinds of themes of longing and desire, and they're rarely sort of happy love songs, right?
Right.
And I think as we've known more about him over the years, he's a very introverted person.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not hard to see where this is coming from, because he's very internally focused, but he's observing.
Yeah.
And so he's writing all this stuff down that he's observing or feeling, even though he may not act out on it. And he's kind of holed himself up in Minneapolis for years now. And he's kind of a hard, prickly personality to get through to.
Yeah.
Now, here's an interesting thing. So one of the comments we got about Skyway, well, it was Nick Scalera who just made his picks by listing lyrics.
Yes.
But the lyric he picked from this, and again, this is, I think, what makes the song so brilliant. The lyric he picked from this was, "Oh, then one day I saw you walking down that little one way."
Right.
So the song kind of turns on its head there at the end in the story, because now she's down on the street and he, you know, he's like, there wasn't a damn thing I could do or say up in the Skyway. I guess he went up there to meet her and then she's down on the street.
Perhaps.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes.
It was a sliding doors moment where they missed each other.
Yeah. Missed it by that much.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really tremendous. Echo Park Jimmy says it's another acoustic gem. Reminds me of driving to Chicago, he says. So, I think he's thinking of the L train in Chicago, maybe as Skyway.
Could be.
Yeah. Ben Montgomery says it's a beautiful, heartbreaking song. And Keith Jacobson says Paul really shines as a songwriter here. I think we agree with all
Absolutely.
Those sentiments, right?
Yeah. Well said, fellas.
I also like on Pleased to Meet Me, which is a record that has a lot of great, just like rocking songs on it, that this is toward the end. And it sort of gives you this kind of release from what you've been listening to on
that
album.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's get out of here. We are now in the top 10.
Sweet. We will get to number nine tomorrow.
Are getting higher.
What
can you feel the tension here in the basement?
We know it's not going to be Stairway to Heaven this time. So we can tell you.
Or what was the controversial Immigrant Song?
That's right.
At number one.
That's right. We know that's not going to happen.
Did Achilles' Last Stand make it in there?
I'll have to double check on my spreadsheet. That was really terrible. My math wasn't really nearly as good, so I'm not really sure. Maybe Immigrant Song really wasn't number one. It was Patrick's bad spreadsheet.
All right, let's go. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
Phil Ingrassi.
And we'll talk to you guys tomorrow with numbers 9, 8, and 7.
Number 9.
Die with him.
Yeah, you've got like a surf, you know, a surf instrumental, which is great. I mean,
oh yeah,
my
Buck Hill. Yeah,
my friend,
a Minnesota reference.
Yeah,
that's
a ski place, right?
off the freeway, and it's like the worst ski area ever. But that's where kids from South Minneapolis and around the area would go ski. Buck Hill, hilarious.